So today AFP Audio is talking to Graham Maguire, who's a respiratory physician at Alice Springs Hospital, Associate Professor at James Cook University and Executive Director of Baker IDI Central Australia. Hi, Graham.
G'day.
So Graham is the author of an article, Bronchiectasis, A Guide for Primary Care, which appears in the November 2012 edition of Australian Family Physician. And it's an article that particularly looks at bronchiectasis not related to cystic fibrosis and incorporates much of the information in some recent Australian guidelines. But to start at the beginning for us, Graham, what is bronchiectasis?
Well, bronchiectasis is a chronic lung disease, and it's defined as really being fixed abnormal dilatation of the airways that's associated with a clinically consistent history. Usually it's someone with chronic respiratory symptoms such as cough, sputum production and shortness of breath.
Yeah. And so what do we know about the burden of disease in Australia?
Well, I'd have to start by saying we know very little about the burden of disease of bronchiectasis in Australia. What we do know is probably best assumed from slightly more accurate American data, which would indicate that the burden of bronchiectasis increases with age. It sort of rises from around 4.2 per 100,000 in people who are young adults from 18 to 34 up to 270 per 100,000 in those older than 75 years. And I suppose this, from a clinical point of view, perhaps might be surprising, since a lot of us think about bronchiectasis in the same sentence as cystic fibrosis, which we know is being a condition particularly of children and young adults. But it just demonstrates that there's a lot of bronchiectasis out there that's not related to cystic fibrosis that's occurring in older people.
Yeah.
The other thing about Australia, I think, is that we also know that there are certain populations that are particularly at risk of earlier onset bronchiectasis. And perhaps the most well-described group are Aboriginal Australians, who we know have more severe disease that's of earlier onset. But again, good national data for the burden of bronchiectasis in Australia for all Australians and for Indigenous Australians remains pretty poor at this stage.
Yep. And so Table 1 in the article provides some information on the possible etiologies and factors associated with bronchiectasis. However, the article makes the point that in more than 80% of cases, there'll be no cause identified. I suppose clinically, one of the things I tend to see more often is the overlap syndromes with people who have a bit of this and a bit of bronchiectasis. What do we know about those?
Well, you're exactly right that particularly as people get older, it's almost very hard to sort of nail a single diagnosis or a single cause driving their chronic respiratory symptoms. And we certainly know that a large proportion of people, who particularly adults who are diagnosed with bronchiectasis, will also have coexistent asthma or COPD. And really that's from really around 15% up to a quarter of people. So it's not surprising from a clinical point of view that sometimes you're wondering, what am I actually treating here? Am I treating someone with COPD, someone with asthma, or someone with bronchiectasis? But the great thing is that clinicians in Australia now are used to dealing with lots of chronic diseases that overlap. So I think it's most people are reasonably comfortable in this space, but it can provide some confusion when you suddenly get a result and you think, oh, it's bronchiectasis, but the patient still wheezes and they seem to get benefit from bronchodilators, so maybe it's asthma as well.
So being aware that the diagnosis may not fit into the beautiful one single box. And I suppose one of the things I really like about the article is at the beginning it doesn't provide quite a long list of all the things that run through a GP's mind when someone presents with some chronic shortness of breath or cough, which is, you know, a vast array of potential differentials. What are some of the things that should make GPs particularly consider bronchiectasis as a potential cause?
Well, I think the key aspect of bronchiectasis and making a diagnosis is really based on taking a step back and looking at the patient. And asking yourself, in someone who's got chronic respiratory symptoms, particularly with sputum production, is it likely this is asthma or COPD? Or if not, then maybe I should be thinking bronchiectasis. So what are the sort of things that make us think asthma? Well, usually it's people who have wheeze and a treatment response associated with particularly fluctuating airflow obstruction that's reversible with bronchodilators. So if you're thinking asthma, but you're managing asthma and they're just not getting better despite the fact you're doing the right things by the guidelines and appropriately escalating therapy, then you should really think about bronchiectasis. The other thing is when you're faced with someone who has a diagnosis of COPD and you think, well, the main risk factor for COPD is cigarette smoking, but this person really hasn't smoked or hasn't smoked much. And so anyone with a lack of a significant smoking history, say less than 20 cigarettes per day for on average 10 years, who's got chronic respiratory symptoms, then again, that's the sort of patient you should be thinking about bronchiectasis.
And if we're thinking about it, what sort of investigation should we consider?
Look, the first thing with someone with chronic respiratory symptoms is a plain chest X-ray. It can really be helpful. The key thing to take away, particularly with bronchiectasis or a lot of other chronic lung disease, is that a chest X-ray isn't particularly sensitive. So a normal chest X-ray shouldn't necessarily reassure you that nothing's going on, of course. But sometimes a chest X-ray can particularly demonstrate other causes for chronic respiratory symptoms. And the big ones that I'd usually be looking at are any evidence of heart failure, so cardiomegaly, evidence of left ventricular failure with interstitial edema, or someone with interstitial lung disease. So seeing sort of reticular shadowing, bilateral sort of fibrotic changes, suddenly you're thinking, well, maybe this could be interstitial lung disease or heart failure rather than something like asthma, COPD, or bronchiectasis. The next thing is, if you really are thinking about bronchiectasis, we know that high-resolution CT scans of the chest are very good in this regard. The concern, I think, sometimes is that in patients who don't have a clinical picture that fits with bronchiectasis, sometimes you can see airway dilatation. And it's sometimes difficult to know, is this airway dilatation really bronchiectasis, or could this be related to something else like an acute infection? And we also know that people with COPD, as they get older, and particularly if they've got low levels of oxygen in their blood, they can get compensatory airway dilatation that can sometimes get confused with bronchiectasis. So I think a high-resolution CT scan in those people in whom there's a reasonable pretest probability of bronchiectasis is reasonable. But just remember, sometimes you can see unexpected findings that are related to other diseases. The caveat with this, and I think we really need to emphasize, is that you need to be a bit careful with performing high-resolution CT scans because they do have a significant radiation dose. Really, a single high-resolution CT of the chest is about the equivalent of 400 plain chest X-rays, or about 4 years of background radiation. So in those people who are particularly sensitive to radiation, so usually that's children and younger adults, then really be a bit cautious in just jumping to a high-resolution CT scan. And in that setting, I really do encourage people to have a chat to either a pediatrician or a respiratory physician, just to have a bit of a think about things before you actually go ahead with the CT.
Yep, excellent advice. So in the article, Table 4 then has some recommended tests for secondary causes, as whilst we pointed out there, it's more common not to find a secondary cause. There is a clear suggestion about what should be done prior to referral and what then the specialist may do. But say someone moves along, is diagnosed with bronchiectasis of unknown etiology, what are the general principles of management then?
Look, the general principles of management, well, there's two real aims here. One is how best to manage acute exacerbations, and the other is long-term strategies for managing their bronchiectasis. So we know acute exacerbations are most likely, though we can't be absolutely sure, but most likely do drive the progression of disease, and certainly they are a substantial cause of morbidity and hospitalisation for people with bronchiectasis. So the first thing with bronchiectasis is that, unlike with a lot of the other infections that we manage, particularly in primary care, we have a reasonably low index for using antibiotics in people with bronchiectasis who look like they're getting an acute exacerbation. And in my clinical practice, I usually like to use a fairly standard definition of acute exacerbation. And so it's usually two or more of increasing cough, shortness of breath, or increasing volume or purulence of the sputum. And the other thing that I will often use is that if someone presents with an unexplained reduction in their lung function over days to a week or weeks, then that also raises a suspicion in my mind in someone with bronchiectasis that they may be having an acute exacerbation. Because as you know, it can be very difficult if someone's bringing up substantial volumes of sputum all the time to know when they're actually getting worse. But just remember, it's the volume of the sputum, and it's also that colour can be a really useful aid. So if someone usually brings up white sputum and it goes to yellow, or if they usually bring up yellow sputum and it goes to green, you should really begin to think that this might be an exacerbation. Because we know the colour of the sputum is actually a de facto marker of the number of inflammatory cells in the sputum. So it looks like their disease is starting to flare up. I suppose the other part of that we've spoken about is the long-term management. Certainly, long-term management, and it's sort of laid out in the article, there's been a lot of new areas that have opened up where we've demonstrated that things that where we can intervene to actually reduce acute exacerbation frequency, improve quality of life, and even improve lung function. And one of the big aspects of that has been the use of inhalational therapy, and particularly in people who have frequent acute exacerbations and who have bugs in their sputum even when they're clinically well. Then things such as long-term nebulized gentamicin for up to 12 months can actually reduce exacerbation frequency and improve quality of life. The other use for longer-term antibiotics that there's been some demonstrated benefit in bronchiectasis has been the use of long-term oral antibiotics, and particularly azithromycin. Now, as we all know, we don't want to be throwing around lots of antibiotics, but again, in patients who have frequent acute exacerbations, so usually it's people who are having 2 to 3 acute exacerbations requiring antibiotics, plus or minus hospitalisation every year, then these people are certainly the sort of patients who it's been demonstrated that a trial of long-term azithromycin may actually improve outcome. Nonetheless, in that setting, I'm usually at the stage where you should be talking to your respiratory colleagues, because if nothing else, you need to actually be able to find a way to be able to provide long-term azithromycin. And as we know, under the PBS, you can't actually prescribe it for a year at a time. So usually the dispensing needs to happen through a hospital pharmacy.
Yep. And I suppose one of the other areas that you probably need to consult is if someone comes up with an atypical mycobacterial disease in their sputum, because that's another area where there seems to be a few options, and the local respiratory team's likely to have a view.
You're exactly right. And particularly in older people, we're increasingly recognising that non-tuberculous mycobacteria, mycobacteria such as Mycobacterium avium complex, can actually be a driver of progression of bronchiectasis. But it can be a bit difficult to diagnose, because we also know there are people with bronchiectasis who are just colonised with this bug, where it's not actually causing a problem. So it's at that time, if the first thing is I recommend that at baseline and usually perhaps annually, you do a mycobacterial culture of the sputum. And if you do come up with one of these non-tuberculous mycobacteria, it's worthwhile having a chat to your local respiratory team and determining what further investigations are required to figure out whether or not the person requires management. Because we know that treating these bugs is difficult. You know, we're talking 1 to 2 years of at least 3 drugs with lots of side effects. So you really don't want to go down the path of treatment unless you're pretty convinced that someone's going to get some benefit.
Yep. And so moving on, the article also suggests pulmonary rehab is probably useful for all patients, but there's also a group who are going to have either quite severe disease, either relatively rapidly or over time. What are some of the considerations for this group?
Well, as someone gets more severe disease, what you really have to do is start watching out for complications. Perhaps the first thing is that as patients get more severe disease, they can get worsening hypoxemia on room air, so the oxygen saturations begin to fall. And in this group of people, this can lead to right heart failure, and that in itself can be what actually knocks them off. So as someone gets more severe disease, it is really useful to see them more frequently and to regularly monitor their oxygen saturation. And if their oxygen saturation is 93% or less, then you should really be thinking about referring them off to a respiratory team for assessment for the appropriateness of long-term oxygen therapy. So the sort of people who use oxygen for 16 to 18 hours a day via nasal prongs at 2 litres a minute, that sort of group. The other thing is, as people get worse, you really need to start asking yourself whether or not this person is a candidate for surgery or transplantation. Now, we know that transplantation is difficult. Organ availability in Australia is limited, and that it's actually, you know, it's a big deal. You need to be reasonably well in yourself to actually survive the experience. Nonetheless, as people's lung function begins to fall, particularly as their FEV1 gets down and approaches 30% of predicted, you really need to start thinking, has this person been assessed for transplantation, and find out whether or not it would be appropriate or not. And it can be very helpful if you know someone who's got advanced disease has been assessed for transplantation. If it wasn't appropriate, then you document that. So then you've got an idea of that you shouldn't be thinking that transplantation is going to get you out of this problem in the long term.
Yep.
In the past, we also looked at chopping out the most affected bit of the lung. And this, I think, now in Australia is particularly reserved for those people who have resistant non-tuberculous mycobacteria. And in that group of people, again, these sort of people are usually under the care of respiratory and infectious diseases physicians. In this group of people in whom there's this localized area of infection that you just can't get rid of with standard therapy, then there is a small role for local resection. But nonetheless, even in this group, there's a very high rate of recurrent disease post-surgery.
Yep. And, I mean, given the prognosis, people with severe disease who aren't transplant candidates probably also should be at least known to or discussed with local palliative care services in an earlier rather than later timeline.
No, I was just going to highlight that there is no doubt that palliative care services can be a really good partner to have on board. It's amazing the improvements in quality of life you can get with the judicious use of anxiolytics, particularly in antidepressants. And always remember in this group that concomitant depression is really common. So I have a low index. You know, in my approach, I have a very low index for managing depression, since it is just so common, really, in anyone who's got an advanced chronic disease, and particularly in this group.
Indeed. So what are some key messages that you want GPs to remember about bronchiectasis after reading the article?
Look, I think the key thing is to think bronchiectasis at any age, And to realize just because you've got a diagnosis of COPD or asthma, it doesn't mean you can't have concomitant bronchiectasis. If you do make a, if you are thinking about making a diagnosis and doing a CT, if they're a child or a young adult, talk to a specialist first. Look for secondary causes because they're treatable, some of them. And remember that, that you shouldn't feel that there's nothing you can do in bronchiectasis. I think this review just outlines that there's a broad range of things we can do to actually help reduce exacerbation frequency and improve quality of life.
Excellent. Well, thank you for talking to us today, and people can read the full article in the November 2012 edition of AFP.
Thanks,
Graham.
Much.